as part of efforts to safeguard national interests and remove sanctions against the country. Israelis hold mass rallies for a 32nd week in a row to protest a judicial reform plan proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right cabinet. And the West African bloc ECOWAS says it is planning to send a parliamentary committee to Niger in a new bid to engage with its coup leaders. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's foreign minister says that the Islamic Republic has never left the negotiating table and will continue efforts for the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said administration of President Ebrahim Raisi's focus on dynamic diplomacy to fulfill national interests since taking office in August of 2021. Remarks came after Iran's foreign ministry confirmed the ongoing process of releasing $6 billion worth of Iranian funds, which have been held in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. It added a number of Iranians who have been detained in the U.S. on baseless accusations will also be released soon. On Saturday, Iran's central bank chief said that all of Iran's frozen funds in South Korea have been unblocked and will be used for non-sanctioned goods.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians, whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions, will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's lives.
The process of releasing Iran's assets in South Korea comes after Iranian funds blocked in Iraq were unfrozen just last month. All those are seen as victories for administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, who's been pursuing a particular type of diplomacy.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy. Policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked fund, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
Political commentator Isha Krishnaswamy says that Israeli lobby in the U.S. is currently pushing hard for anti-Iran sanctions to remain in place, and this complicates sanctions removal talks.
As we know, in the West, there is a big lobbying effort from both Israel and Saudi Arabia that kind of fights against Iranians' interest. And unfortunately, a lot of this lobbying efforts have been successful in poisoning the well against Iran. And of course, most media outlets do not explain both the economic power and how some companies have an umbrella beyond the sanctions in order to protect themselves from getting in trouble with the US. So medical equipment is an excellent example where even in situations where it's legal, many companies will not export to Iran because they want to have a safe harbor. So, yeah, and so unfortunately, as long as these interests in Washington continue, they will be pushing hard for continuing sanctions, and the situation is unlikely to change.
Now, welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, Saudi Arabia has named a non-resident ambassador for the occupied Palestinian territories, who also served as a consul general in Al-Quds. The announcement marks the first time the kingdom will have official diplomatic representation in Palestine. The role will be filled by a current Saudi ambassador to Jordan, who traditionally handles the Palestine file for Riyadh. Saudi Arabia said move is an important step which underscores the desire to boost ties with the state of Palestine. The announcement comes amid reports that Riyadh and Washington have held talks on Saudi conditions for normalization with Israel. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us out of Montreal, and Christopher Hilali, researcher and political analyst, joining us at our Verchar, Vermont. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in overcast Montreal. Yves, hope you're safe and doing well. Your thoughts about the Saudis and their Palestine approach. This could have taken place a lot sooner. Is it an okey-doke, or is it sincere, or is this a part of getting a bone from Washington, or is this really sincere and more reflective of the Saudis gravitating toward the East and China and becoming more endeared to the Palestinians and their cause?
I guess the my simple answer would be I'm not sure. I think this is a Saudi messaging that they are, if there's going to be some normalization with Israel, that they do want some concession to Palestinians. So I think that that is a messaging that, that Riyadh is trying to deliver to both Tel Aviv and to Washington. I think that, you know, more generally, I personally, the idea of deepening ties with the Palestinian Authority, I think it's very clear at this point that Abbas is little more than the Israel's authority over Palestinians in the West Bank. The Israelis are even boasting about that pretty openly now. So I don't know that that's necessarily a, you know, bolstering the PA at this point necessarily a good thing. I think that it is also, there is also this other dynamic. I mean, clearly what's going on in the background in part is that the agreement between, overseen by China in terms of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that is something that the Americans clearly didn't like, don't like. They want, they're concerned about China's growing economic ties to Saudi Arabia and obviously also China's growing diplomatic influence in the region. And so the Americans are trying to push back on that, and they're trying to push potentially even, you know, offering some sort of security guarantee to Saudis, which is really about protecting or focused on Iran, protecting, I don't know if that's the right word, but focused on sort of the Saudi and Iranian relations. So I don't know. I think that this is, you know, in principle, it is obviously a good thing to increase sort of concern for the Palestinians in this way, and to provide a little bit of a poke in the finger of the Israeli government. But I think we're going to need a lot more time to have a clear assessment.
Thank you there, Yves. And Christopher, welcome to the program. Now, Christopher, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, reportedly stated back in 2018, quote unquote, Palestinians should accept peace or shut up and stop complaining. And that prompted protests from Palestinians. And then Saudi King Salman, he once again tried to confirm support of the Saudis for Palestine, and said that he still fully supports, going back to pre-1967 borders, and fully supports. So there's rifts, there's divisions in the top echelon of the Saudi family. Your thoughts on the Saudi Arabia now naming a non-resident ambassador for occupied Palestinian territories, who's also going to serve as consul general in Al-Quds. What does this tell us at this point in the game, if anything?
I think it tells us, number one, that Saudi Arabia is finding a new role and a new place as an important diplomatic maker, sort of kingmaker in the region. And this is in part due to their bridging that they are doing between the East, especially China, and also Russia, the BRICS countries, and then with the West, especially with the United States, who's always seen the Saudi Arabia as a very close client state, one that it has benefited tremendously from in terms of oil revenue and security. And so I think it's important to recognize here that Saudi Arabia now is positioning itself vis-a-vis these two blocks, if you want to say. And now with this, with the Abraham Accords under President Trump, we saw some level of normalization between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, by extension, and Israel. The only thing here to recognize, and what many people are now coming and saying, is that an agreement that was reached was that if, for example, the United Arab Emirates normalized relations with Israel, the United States would provide the UAE with state-of-the-art U.S. military equipment. Now, after the agreement was signed, before the ink was dry, Israel blocked the transfer. Went to Washington through its lobbyist arms and blocked the transfer of those arms to the UAE. So if in a similar vein, if Saudi Arabia is looking for a major weapons deal or a deal for civilian nuclear program, as they've been saying. Any sort of big economic military concession, in terms of normalizing relations with Israel, there could be a block that comes anyway. So there's no guarantee. And also, this is the most right-wing government in Israeli history. What kind of concessions is Saudi Arabia going to get in terms of a Palestinian state and helping the Palestinians? This is the incremental approach that has always served the Zionist regime in continuing in its expansion of settlements, in continuing its occupation throughout the occupied territories, but also its expansion in East Jerusalem, in Al-Khalil, what the Israelis called Hebron, many important places of worship for Muslims and also for Christians. And so there's really, the fact that they have now a representative there, is a good step. But the concessions is the real question here. And I don't think that we're going to get much. I think it's going to be short-term gain, long-term pain again.
Yeah, it's been always a pleasure. Thank you both, and stay safe to both of you. That was Yves Zangler there, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal, and Christopher Helali, researcher and political analyst, joining us from Vermont. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Tens of thousands of Israelis throng the streets of Tel Aviv for a 32nd week in a row, protesting hard-right cabinet's judicial overhaul, which will see the highest court stripped of most of its powers. People carried a massive banner with pictures of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other ministers, with a caption, "Israel's coup criminals." More than 150 other demonstrations were slated to take place in other towns as well as outside homes of Israeli officials. Organizers said judicial coup has led to racist policies, the collapse of the police, and the beginning of a wave of immigration. Despite massive backlash, though, Netanyahu says he will move ahead with the changes. Planned judicial overhaul, which was proposed in January, has sparked massive protests and criticism at home and abroad. Israel's main ally, the U.S., has also criticized the move. West Africa's regional bloc ECOWAS says it aims to send a parliamentary committee to Niger to meet coup leaders who took power last month. The committee seeks to give permission of the Nigerian president, who holds ECOWAS chairmanship, for the overture. Now, Nigerian religious leaders have already met with coup leaders in Niamey. According to media reports, they explained to junta leaders that Nigeria is not fighting Niger. Any decisions taken on Niger are not Nigeria's, but those of ECOWAS. Niger's military last month imprisoned President Mohamed Bazoum. Takeover has drawn condemnation from ECOWAS, which has threatened military action against Niger if coup leaders do not release and reinstate the president. White House says the U.S. President Joe Biden's comment about China being a ticking time bomb refers to its internal economic and social tensions. Spokesperson John Kirby said that these tensions can have an effect on how Beijing interacts with the world. He said one area of U.S. concern regarding China is the way Beijing bullies and coerces and intimidates countries around the world by offering high-interest infrastructure loans and then seizes assets when countries default. On Thursday, Biden said at a political fundraiser, China is in trouble and beset with economic and social problems. Comments have drawn sharp response from Beijing. Chinese embassy spokesperson Li Pengyu warned Washington against scapegoating Beijing and fanning division and confrontation. China's Ministry of Commerce also accused Washington of frequently breaching World Trade Organization rules and damaging the shared interests of its members. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament unveiled plans to operate direct flights between Tehran and Hanoi. Speaking at a joint press conference with Chairman of Vietnam's National Assembly, Vung Dinh Hue, held in Tehran recently, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf said they have held talks on a range of political and economic issues. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf has hailed the friendly ties between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Vietnam, saying the two countries have agreed to expand their cooperation in various fields. Ghalibaf made the remarks at a joint press conference with Chairman of Vietnam's National Assembly, Vung Dinh Ho, in the capital, Tehran, after the two officials held talks on a range of political and economic issues. He went on to say that during the meeting, the two sides emphasized the need for the establishment of joint committees between Iran and Vietnam to boost cooperation in economic, fishery, health, and medical sectors. Ghalibaf also noted that the two sides have reached agreements on customs and not collecting taxes on imported goods, stressing the need to accelerate their implementation. He further pointed to an agreement on easing the visa regime between the two countries, saying direct flights between Tehran and Hanoi will be launched soon. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian Parliament Speaker described Hugh's trip to Iran as a turning point in the development of ties between the two nations in various economic, cultural, and social fields. He further said a top foreign policy priority of Iran is to pay a special attention to East Asia and expand ties with the countries of that region. Hugh, for his part, appreciated his Iranian counterpart for inviting him to travel to Iran, expressing hope that the trip would help further strengthen the ties between Iran and Vietnam. He also lauded Iran's significant role in West Asia, adding that Hanoi pays attention to the promotion of collaboration between the two countries in various parliamentary, governmental, municipality, and friendship groups. At the end of the press conference, the two top parliamentarians signed a memorandum of understanding on parliamentary cooperation between the two countries. Iran and Vietnam established relations in 1973, and since then, the two countries have increased political and economic cooperation through exchange of visits by senior officials from both sides. Vietnam News also had an eye on this issue, writing, Vietnam and Iran have agreed to further enhance bilateral cooperation in various fields, particularly in trade and investment, to facilitate the entry of each country's key products into the other's market. National Assembly Chairman Wang Dinhu held talks with the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, during his official visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran at the invitation of the Speaker. NA Chairman Hugh expressed his pleasure in visiting Iran, a country with a rich cultural heritage and long history, especially given both nations are celebrating 50 years of diplomatic relations this year. He affirmed that Vietnam highly valued the friendly relationship and multifaceted cooperation with Iran, a crucial partner in the West Asia region. He highlighted the positive developments in the bilateral cooperation between the two countries in recent years, particularly in political, diplomatic, cultural, and people-to-people exchanges. For his part, a Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, welcomed Hugh's visit, emphasizing that Vietnam is a significant partner for Iran in the Asia-Pacific region. He expressed confidence that the cooperation between Vietnam and Iran, as well as between their parliaments, would witness remarkable growth in the coming period. Vietnam News also added the two leaders exchanged views and reached a consensus on specific measures to enhance bilateral cooperation in the future. These measures included strengthening exchanges at all levels, especially high-level delegations and leadership of economic sectors and localities from both countries, alongside boosting people-to-people exchanges as well as cultural and artistic activities to deepen mutual understanding and enhancing collaboration between committees and bodies of the parliaments, parliamentary friendship groups, women and young parliamentarians groups. They also agreed to ensure effective monitoring and implementation of agreements and commitments between the two nations to enhance mutual support in international forums and prepare for the 10th meeting of the Vietnam-Iran Intergovernmental Committee in Hanoi. Both sides also agreed to intensify meetings and connections between localities and businesses of both nations to explore investment opportunities. NA Chairman Hugh suggested that Iran increase imports of Vietnamese agricultural products such as rice, tea, pepper, coffee, and rubber, while expressing Vietnam's readiness to facilitate Iran's exports of fruits, including dried fruits, to Vietnam. Both sides concurred on cooperation in producing products according to halal food standard. A According to the outlet, the leaders also agreed to enhance customs cooperation and revive mechanisms of collaboration between the two nations, such as the Joint Working Group on Banking Cooperation and the Vietnam-Iran Trade Task Force, to seek breakthroughs in economic and trade cooperation. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament noted that Iranian businesses were increasingly interested in the Vietnamese market due to its political stability and favorable investment business environment, aiming to strengthen trade and agricultural cooperation with Vietnam. During the talks, both sides discussed various measures to enhance cooperation in political areas such as science and technology, digital transformation, education and training, as well as promoting and attracting tourism from each country. Hoi took this occasion to invite the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament to visit Vietnam, which he gladly accepted. He also invited the Iranian Parliament to send a delegation to participate in the 9th Global Conference of Young Parliamentarians, scheduled to be held in Hanoi in September. NA Chairman and Speaker of the Iranian Parliament signed a Memorandum of Understanding on cooperation between the two parliaments.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani are two special guest speakers for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Rouhani. Welcome to you, Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of Shahada and Shaheed, who is called Shaheed. Shaheed, of course, in English is roughly translated into martyr, and Shahada as martyrdom. And why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is called the master or the prince of all the Shuhada around the world. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us a definition of the concept of Shahada and martyrdom. What is it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I should affirm my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam to the respected listeners. And of course, when it comes to Shahada and martyrdom, from the Islamic perspective, Shaheed or martyr is the one who sacrificed himself for the sake of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and is martyred by the enemy of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, mostly in the battlefields. So that's why when a Muslim defend Islam or defend Islamic territory, Islamic ummah, nation, beliefs,
yes,
against the enemies of Islam and participate in the jihad and struggling in the, against the enemies of Islam for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then in the battlefield, if he got killed and murdered by the enemies of Islam, so this person is called Shaheed, yes, martyred, which has its special rulings according to Islamic jurisprudence.
That's all right. And Sheikh Fadai, when we talk about the concept of martyrdom, and for sure we are talking about the concept of death, but what makes Shaheed and Shahada significant in Islam is the main goal which is set for such a person or such a concept. What is the main goal behind the concept of Shahada?
Yes, as you know, all of us will die.
Yes.
And death is something that we cannot escape from that. But the difference between death and Shahada is that by Shahada you can choose your way, mm-hmm, first of all.
Yes.
It's a chosen way of death. And you can be an example and pattern for all people. This is what makes it special.
Yes.
You know, when someone goes in the way of God and sacrifices himself, it means that all society can watch him as a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't live just for ourselves in order to gain some property and have a good living for ourselves. It's not a living that God considered it for us.
Yes.
We have in Quran, مَا خَلَقْتُ الْإِنسَ وَالْجِنَّ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ.
Yes.
So our final goal is ibadah. We're not some animal. We're human beings. If we want to live like animals, just gather something for ourselves and, I don't know, protect our children, loving each other, having a good life. So what is the difference between us and the animals?
Yes.
The difference is that we have a final goal. And yes, for that final goal, we should struggle. Yes. We should try as much as we can. Mm-hmm. Because of that, we call our battle jihad.
Yes.
Jihad means to do your best in the way of mm-hmm. God. What yes. is the way of God? That ibadah, illa liya'budun. Mm-hmm. So shaheed is someone that did his best or her best in the way of God and made himself a pattern, an example for all people. This yes. is the way of life.
Yes.
You're not animal. Mm-hmm. So when you sacrifice all the best thing that you have, what is the best thing that you have? Your life.
Mm-hmm.
When you sacrifice that for yes. God, it means that I am for God and I live for God.
So for sure, shahada is a concept for divine causes.
Yes, okay. It is for divine causes.
Yes.
You know, of course, maybe some other in other monotheistic beliefs and religions,
yes.
They have this same meaning, the concept of shahada.
Yes, yes.
In for example, Judaism and Christianity.
Yes, yes.
And nowadays, maybe a lot of distorted beliefs, mm-hmm. they believe in shahada and they okay. considered the people who died in the battles mm-hmm. As shaheed, but it's
okay.
not like that.
Okay.
When we say divine concept, it means that it should be in the right way,
mm-hmm.
not just what we call it the right way. Everyone believes that he's right.
Yes.
No. First of all, we should find what is the right way. What is the divine way?
Yes.
So after we find that divine way, we struggle and do our best in mm-hmm. that way. And we try to sacrifice everything,
yes.
our property, our life, in the way of God.
That's right.
So the last point, the final point is shahada. And it's not like everyone can reach that point.
That's right.
That's the last one.
Okay.
So it's hard to reach.
It's a high level. That's right. But Sheikh Rani, as Sheikh Fadai said, so shahada, martyrdom, is a concept which is not limited to Islam. Before Islam, we got this concept too. For example, it is believed that, for example, Prophet Yahya or the other prophets and the faithful, for example, companions of the prophets who were killed for the way of Allah or conveying the messages of Allah were considered as shaheed. Now, the main question is that, did we have such a concept from early Islam? I mean, the people who were killed, for example, in the battles against the kuffar, infidels, and unbelievers at the time of Prophet Muhammad were also called shaheed or not?
Yes. First of all, we should know that the term shaheed is not used, for example, in the Holy Quran.
Uh-huh.
For example, we have a very nice ayah about shuhada that says that وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. So
yes.
قُتِلُوا means the one who is killed.
Mm-hmm.
So this the term which is used for shaheed is قَتِيل.
Yes.
Or the one who is killed by the enemy of the Islam. So that's why if you mean that the exact term shaheed
yes.
Was used for example, shuhada in the Holy Quran, for example, in the first years of Islam, we might not find this
yes.
term.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the concept of shahada, the concept of martyrdom, yeah, of course, it was used for the first shaheed of Islam, which was Ammar ibn Yasir, for example,
yes.
and later in the Battle of Uhud, Hamza al-Sayyid al-Shuhada and many other Shuhada,
yes.
yeah, they were considered among the first Shuhada of Islam.
Even Hamza was called Sayyid al-Shuhada.
Of course, yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes. Okay.
This term was used for
yes,
him.
Yes.
So that is why Shuhada is, of course, as our respected brother rightly mentioned, death is coming to us, but the best way, the best death is Shuhada, is martyrdom.
Yes.
Because Shaheed departures this world in the best and the most perfect way, in the most mm-hmm. beautiful way,
yes.
because he is directly taken into the presence of Almighty Allah subhanahu
yes.
wa ta'ala and is forgiven.
Yes.
So that's why shahada is the best experience for someone's who can experience at the mm-hmm. end of his life.
Yes.
And
but so it is not a kind of, because some people say it might be like committing suicide
no,
or
no,
something
never,
like
never.
That.
Not
what is the main
that
difference?
You yourself kill yourself,
uh-huh.
you know?
Okay, okay. in a defensive
enemy,
form.
Kill you, not you yourself, of course.
And you must be in defense of a value, isn't it?
Exactly. In the Holy Quran, it said that وَلَا تُلْقُوا بِأَيْدِيكُمْ إِلَى التَّحَلُّكَ. You yourself should not put yourself into
danger.
Yeah, that is the point that we should mention. Sometimes, there is a misconception about even about Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi wasalam. Some people say that if Imam Hussein knew that he will be killed by Yazid, so it was a kind of intihar. It was a kind of suicide, committing suicide. Yeah.
Yes.
But it's wrong, because Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam was defending Islam, was defending the religion of his grandfather, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam. In the battlefield, he was killed by the enemies of
Islam.
That's right. Okay. That's why he is called Shaheed.
That's right. And Sheikh Fadai, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is considered as the emir or prince of the martyrs of all time, Sayyid al-Shuhada, both in this world and the other world, And during all the eras, during the history, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is always a person who sacrificed everything he had for the cause of Islam and his values. How do you think Imam al-Hussein can be titled as Sayyid al-Shuhada?
You know, first of all, let me complete what I told you in the previous part. As I told you, Shaheed is a patron.
Yes.
And Imam Hussein is the highest level of that position. As you know, nowadays, even in the way of battle, they try to make pattern. No, they cannot force people to go toward the way of battle. They make a lot of wrong pattern, like celebrities, for example. You know, Shaheed, Shuhadas are our celebrities. The correct ones are our pattern. And the highest level in this way, making pattern, is Imam Hussein, which is called Sayyid al-Shuhada. About this title, Sayyid al-Shuhada, I have to say that we have two famous people called Sayyid al-Shuhada, and both of them were called by Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The first of them is Hamza, the uncle of Prophet, because of his position at the first days of and years of Islam.
Yes.
He protected Prophet in Islam as much as he could. And after he was killed in the Battle of Uhud, and of course in a brutal way, Prophet called him Sayyid al-Shuhada.
Yes.
And we have some hadith about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that Prophet sallallahu alayhi salam called Imam Hussein Sayyid al-Shuhada as well. So the title was given to Imam Hussein by Prophet.
Yes.
But this title was common after the time of Imam Sadiq, the sixth Imam.
Yes.
It was in the times of people that called Imam Hussein. And I can mention two reasons why did Prophet give this title to Imam Hussein. And why is it common nowadays? We believe that. Maybe, in my opinion, maybe these two reasons can be considered. The first of them is that the way of killing Imam Hussein and his martyrdom was the most brutal, the most innocent way of killing and shahada. We cannot find in the history, even when we check some parts of history, even the contemporary era, like Daesh, I don't
know. Yes, the ISIS.
We cannot find like that. That you can, a person in front of his family, you can all of his family, you capture all his family. And the way of killing, which is written and preserved in the Maqatil. You know, usually we don't read the books. We just go to the Majalis and listen to Rosa. It's better for our audience. Sometimes, like a book, like a usual book, it's better to read the maqtals in order to know when we say Imam Hussein is mazloom, is innocent, what does it mean? You know, without studying, we cannot understand why do we call it Sayyid al-Shuhada. This is the first reason, the most innocent, the most brutal way of killing. The second one is that this way of martyrdom was the most effective martyrdom in the history. You know, yes, as you said, we have Yahya, Prophet Yahya.
Yes, yes.
We had Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada. We had a lot of martyrs before Islam and in the era of Islam. But none of them was effective as Imam Hussein.
Yes. You and how effective, you mean?
You know, Even nowadays, you can see that all oppressed people try to take lesson from Imam Hussein Shahada. Okay. Even the people who are not Muslim, like Gandhi.
Yes.
He said that the nation of India should make Imam Hussein as their pattern if they want to be successful. Mm-hmm. So this is the effectiveness of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. So this is Sayyid al-Shahada.
Yes.
We don't
so the values Imam Hussein was martyred for are not limited to the religion of Islam. They're global.
Of course not. It is global.
Yes, yes.
And we can see this reality nowadays in the even Sunni countries like Palestine, I don't know, Pakistan, in this country which is not Muslim like India.
Yes.
There are Buddhists. Buddhism is the first religion in India, but they accept Imam Hussein. They have some ceremonies for Imam Hussein.
That's all
so
right.
So this is the effect of Shahada Imam Hussein, Sayyid al-Shahada.
Okay. And as we said, Shahada is not committing suicide, is not self-killing. It is a kind of defensive, we can say, that's all right, death in the way of Allah for something valuable, as Imam Hussein alayhi salam did. It was for justice. It was for, we can say, acting against oppression of Yazid on that time. It was even for social gap that existed between, we can say, the high and lower parts of the society.
And we shouldn't deceive ourselves to change those values.
Yes.
To change values and making suicide or killing some other people, killing ourselves, and then call it shaheed. It is some, we can call it deceiving ourselves.
Yes. Self-deception.
No, shahada cannot be changed by these concepts.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of Shahada and Shaheed martyrdom and martyr, and why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is called Sayyid al-Shuhada. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Allahu Akbar, jibitni al-Karbala. خويا يا حسين دشوف العائلة الله أكبر جبتني الكربلاء خويا يا حسين دشوف العائلة.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Experts predicted a looming hunger cliff in the United States back in March, and they were right. According to new data, food insecurity in the United States reaches its highest number since December 2020. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, back in March, as expanded pandemic era supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits expired, food insecurity experts were concerned that the United States was racing towards a looming hunger cliff. Now it seems that their predictions were correct, according to new data from the Census Bureau. As the Alliance to End Hunger wrote in a June 30 email, 26.5 million Americans reported food insecurity as of June 19th, according to the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, the most thus far in 2023 and the highest number since December 2020. During the pandemic, SNAP benefits were essentially supercharged as Americans faced furloughs, unemployment, and widespread supply chain disruptions, which had already thrown the grocery buying experience into disarray, in a surge that was categorized as an unprecedented expansion by the New York Times. Jason D. Parrell, more than 6 million people enrolled for food stamps during the first 3 months of the pandemic. While SNAP benefits typically vary based on a recipient's income, during the temporary congressional expansion, recipients were offered the maximum aid available for their household size. However, those benefits were cut months early as part of a bipartisan compromise surrounding a program to provide grocery benefits to replace school meals for low-income children. At the time, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research and policy institute, reported that the average SNAP recipient would receive at least $90 less per month. The center reported some households who, under regular SNAP rules, receive low benefits because they have somewhat higher but still modest incomes will see reductions of $250 a month or more. The average person will receive about $90 a month less in SNAP benefits. In a March statement to Sloan Food, Eric Mitchell, the executive director of the Alliance to End Hunger, wrote that there is never a good time to make it harder for people to buy food. But ending benefits now comes at a particularly bad time. Mitchell said, with inflation and food prices still near record levels, it is still far too expensive for many Americans across the country to put food on the table. Without these extra dollars, millions of people will be at risk of hunger. He continued, writing that the expanded benefits were a lifesaver for many individuals and families as jobs disappeared and the economy grinded to a halt. In the ensuing months, the SNAP program has undergone some permanent changes, the most notable being that the age bracket for people who must meet work requirements in order to participate in the program was expanded. As Salon Food reported in June, this was one of the several concessions made by Democrats as part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling, which the country needed to do later this year to avoid a default crisis. Prior to the pandemic, people younger than 50 who met certain requirements had to volunteer, work, or receive job training for 80 hours a month in order to receive regular assistance. Now, as part of the new budget cuts package, recipients are required to work until the age of 55. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the new stipulations also make it harder for states to waive those work rules in states. Yet after weeks of debate, the new budget cuts package now raises the age of recipients required to work to 55, and according to the Center for Public Integrity, makes it harder for states to waive work rules in areas with high unemployment. Notable exceptions include if someone is experiencing homelessness, is a military veteran, or if they are a youth aged 18 to 24 who has aged out of the foster care system. Currently, there are also two bills under review that would prevent current SNAP recipients from buying junk food classified as candy, ice cream, and prepared desserts such as cakes, pies, cookies, or similar products with their benefits. Several hunger experts have raised concern at both developments, especially in light of the newest food insecurity numbers. According to the Center on Budget Policies and Priorities, the expansion of working age would take food assistance away from large numbers of people, including many who have serious barriers to employment, as well as others who are working or should be exempt but are caught up in red tape. Meanwhile, a spokesperson from the Agriculture Department told Spectrum News that further monitoring of what SNAP recipients purchase with their benefits would increase program cost and complexity and undermine the dignity of millions of Americans by assuming that low-income Americans are unable to make decisions that are best for themselves and their families. According to NBC News, with food prices up 6.7% compared to this time last year, the United States service members and their families experience food insecurity at higher rates than the general public. Also, Guardian had reported food insecurity remains stubbornly high in the United States. According to Guardian, 1 in 10 American households struggled to feed their families last year, with more than 5 million families missing meals and cutting portions due to poverty, new government research has revealed.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran will continue diplomacy as part of efforts to safeguard the national interest.